And we are back on the Peter Schiff Show. Tom Woods in for Peter today. Very happy to welcome to the program right now Mark Thornton. Mark is a senior fellow with the Ludwig von Mises Institute, holds a PhD in economics from Auburn University, which is one of the universities where he has taught economics over the years. He's the author of The Economics of Prohibition. He's co-author of a book called Tariffs, Blockades, and Inflation, The Economics of the Civil War. He's book review editor for the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. And we're going to talk today about a lot of current events. Mark, very glad to welcome you to the Peter Schiff Show. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Tom. It's great to hear you. It's great to be on the show.
Thanks a lot. Now, let's jump right in here, because I asked you before we went on, what sorts of things have you been writing about, been on your mind? I read your article on inflation, so we'll get to that in a minute. But what is the deal here? Peter's had some commentary on this, but what's going on with the German gold repatriation? Why do they want their gold back? And is the response to this request just normal? I mean, is this just a matter of, well, we need to ensure the gold going from one place to another, and it takes a lot of time, and that's why we're taking all this time? Like, is there an innocent explanation? What's happening here?
Well, they're not giving out a lot of information, Tom, but the German people are very uneasy about their position within the European economic community, because they're viewed as the big bailout nation. And so they're worried about the euro. They're worried about the economy. They asked the Federal Reserve for an audit of their gold holdings, which the Fed then refused. And so Germany made this request to get back some of its gold. It asked for 300 tons, which is a small percentage of their overall holdings at the Fed. The curious thing, though, is that, you know, mainstream economists dismiss this whole thing as just silly, and that it's unimportant and that gold is just a relic of history. But the interesting thing for me is that the New York Fed is not going to deliver those 300 tons until 2020, 7 years from now. So the Fed is not exactly like Domino's Pizza.
Right. Now, that is true. So do you think now on this issue of refusing to do this audit? I mean, it's not like Germany is like a small player that, you know, that you could just treat with contempt. Can you conceive of an innocent explanation as to why the Fed would not consent to such an audit?
No, I can't. I mean, it's just preposterous, the idea that it would take 7 years to move a mere 300 tons of gold. Even given security concerns and things of that nature, you know, moving that's not a humongous amount of gold. I mean, that would still leave more than 1,000 tons of German gold at the New York Fed. So, you know, there's no logical or logistical reason why they couldn't get that gold within, say, 1 year period of time. So that leaves us thinking that there's been some funny business going on at the Federal Reserve. You know, they run a fractional reserve banking system, and so it's not too much of a leap to figure that they might be using a fractional gold holding system as well. And people have speculated that what's been going on here is that the Fed and other central banks have been selling gold or leasing gold to gold banks, who in turn then sell the gold and buy bonds so that they can make money on the interest on the bonds. And by selling the gold into the market, at least temporarily, that has a depressive effect on the price of gold, which makes, you know, which is something that central banks like. They don't like to see rising ever higher gold prices. And so one way of suppressing gold prices, people have speculated, is that the central banks would sell some of their gold holdings, which then gets they lease their gold holdings to people who then sell the gold, and that depresses the price of gold.
Do you think we can expect more requests of the nature that we saw from Germany now in light of how Germany's request was handled?
I think so. I mean, you know, our enemies have already requested their gold, like Venezuela and things of that nature. Iran got its gold back, and the Germans have requested most of their gold held at, in England to be returned, and they've requested all of their gold in France to be returned. And so and we see other central banks around the world adding to their gold holdings, particularly countries like China has added significantly. Some believe that it may have even surpassed Germany as the second largest holder of gold. India has made some large purchases. So the whole game has changed here, and central banks, even though they loathe to admit it, realize that real money is gold, and that the paper money that they're dealing in is losing face value.
All right, let's switch gears now. Let's talk a little bit about something you wrote a few weeks ago. You were more or less weighing in on a discussion that's been going on between, well, if you can call it a discussion, that would, I think, dignify it too much. But Paul Krugman has been highly critical of people who predicted that the price level would rise to a particular height because of what the Fed has been doing, and the CPI hasn't risen to that extent. And so Krugman is claiming this is a vindication of his whole approach, and it's a devastating strike against competing approaches, particularly the Austrian. And you weighed in on this with an article called "Where is the Inflation?" How do you sort this out? Is it a mystery as to why prices haven't risen, or have they not risen? How do you make sense of this?
No, there's no mystery at all. I mean, the quantity theory of money tells us that if you increase the supply of money, that prices will go up. There's nothing particularly Austrian about that. So the idea that Krugman is somehow unseating the Austrian economists or condemning the Austrian economists just isn't so. In fact, we're the only ones that can actually explain how prices have actually turned out as a result of this massive inflation of the money supply and the monetary base. It hasn't gone into consumer prices. Consumer prices are up, as measured by the government, about 2%. Using older measures, CPI is up 6, 7, or 8%. But where the money is really going, and that's what you have to find out, is where is the money really going? And if we look at markets around the world other than consumer goods, we find that the price of oil is over $100 a barrel. Gasoline in Auburn, Alabama, went up 5% last week alone. The price of gold is very high, near historic high levels. Commodity prices in general, you know, the things we build houses with, the things we consume as corporations and businesses, all of the prices of those things are at or near record high levels. And so if you look at the financial markets, what we see is government bonds and corporate bonds and junk bonds are at all-time record highs. The stock market is at an all-time record highs. We see real estate markets higher significantly in some cases, all-time record highs in real estate in New York City, in Washington, D.C., in San Francisco. We see art prices at the Sotheby's and Christie's at all-time record highs in terms of the size of the auction and record prices for particular artists. So if we look outside that narrow consumer index of prices, what we find is prices are exploding across the board and are at or near all-time record highs. So there's the inflation is showing up in those kind of markets rather than in the markets for consumer goods and things of that sort.
Well, can you describe the mechanism by which that would be the case? I mean, it would seem to the untrained mind that all prices should just rise. Like, why would there be this kind of segregation of goods in financial markets or commodities, whereas toothbrushes are roughly the same as they've been? Like, why should that be?
Well, because of how they're injecting the money into the economy. The money is going into the hands of banks and financial firms, and the money goes from there into capital goods and into assets. And so the money is flowing from the Fed to the banks and the financial firms, where the money is then placed into government bonds, corporate bonds, junk bonds. It's placed into the stock market. It's placed into real estate and things of that sort. So the money is flowing exactly the way the system works, but it's not going to the consumer. I just saw a study out yesterday that showed that the overall cost of the government bailing out our economy was $12 trillion. 11 of that $12 trillion went through the banking system, and less than a trillion of it went actually to American citizens. And so the money is flowing to the banks, to financial firms, and then to financial markets. The reason art prices are high is because all those hedge fund managers, all the mutual fund managers and dealers in securities in New York City, they're making tons of money. And so they're using that money, in terms of consumption, in buying contemporary art and modern art. And so you see those auctions exploding because there's just so much money there. Now, that money doesn't get to Auburn, Alabama, or Kansas, or Des Moines for a long period of time. And by the time it gets to us, the prices of those consumer goods will already have been bid up. So eventually it'll get into consumer goods. It's not going to be a good thing, obviously, but eventually it'll end up there.
Now, isn't it the case, though, that if the banks aren't – I mean, obviously we know there's a huge unprecedented amount of reserves that the banks are sitting on and that they're holding at the Fed, and excess reserves. And if they are not going to lend this out, or they're just going to sit on it, this obviously does limit the amount of the price inflation that we see. So wouldn't that also be another reason that we don't see prices exploding to quite the extent, like proportionately to the money supply increase? If the banks don't lend it out, then it has no way of getting out into the general economy. So it's not exactly – you don't have to hire a private detective to figure out why prices aren't going through the roof for consumer goods.
That's correct. The money that the Fed has given to the banks, most of that is being held as excess reserves. And traditionally, the banking system as a whole did not hold any excess reserves. And now they hold an amount of excess reserves that equal the entire deposit base of the banking system. So this is really unprecedented. And they're not lending that money. They're keeping it on the books at the Fed, earning interest. The Fed is paying them interest to not lend the money. And so under normal circumstances, if the bank started lending that money to people for mortgages and cars and business loans, then the money would actually get into the hands of the average American. And then you would see that process where the money is lent, it's spent into the economy. The money multiplier effect means that the actual amount of money circulating in the economy would be even greater than the amount of money that the banks currently hold. And so Americans would be starting to bid against one another for lumber and for car parts and the normal things that are in the consumer price index. And so that's when the consumer prices would really take off, is once the banks start lending that money.
All right, we're going to take a quick break right now. And when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Mark Thornton. And I'm going to ask him about the housing bubble, how he spotted this so early, what was he seeing that other people weren't seeing, and frankly, why weren't they seeing it? That's coming up next on The Peter Schiff Show, the gold standard in talk radio.
Well, don't try to change the subject again. Hide and seek with yourself, it ain't a game.
All right, everybody, we're back on The Peter Schiff Show. Tom Woods in for Peter, joined by Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute. Mark, you were one of the first people to start talking about, warning about the housing bubble. First of all, can you tell us, when did you start talking about this, and what exactly were you saying? What were the particular aspects of the housing market that alarmed you or made you think that maybe there was something out of whack there, where what we were seeing in terms of prices was not in line with the fundamentals?
Well, Tom, you'll remember that the Federal Reserve cut the interest rates to 1%, which was historically the lowest level it had ever gone to at that point. So we were on guard. We were looking out for where is the bubble going to form. And it wasn't too hard to really figure out that it was going to be a housing bubble, because very often the Fed creates real estate-related bubbles. And so we were on looking out for this. And early February of 2004, wrote an article about the housing bubble for LouRockwell.com. And the response to that was kind of interesting, because people were enraged that I would suggest that there was a housing bubble in the economy. Everybody was saying, you always make money in real estate, and housing prices never go down, and, things of that nature. You can't lose money in real estate. And what I was saying was just, against all that. I was saying that, yeah, people are going to lose money, because housing starts, housing investment, housing prices, housing inventories, all of the indicators in the housing sector were suggesting that housing was being way, way overdone, and that there were too many houses being built. The housing prices were going up at a much higher rate than they had ever done in the past. And so it was clear to me that there was a housing bubble, and I got a lot of speaking engagements, actually, which were more like ambushes, where I would make my presentation about why there is a housing bubble, why this could be dramatically difficult for the U.S. economy going forward. And, you know, people hated that because I was, you know, taking away the punch bowl, so to speak. And so people were very upset. But the housing bubble continued on for about another year and a half before the bubble broke. We also wrote an article about that right at the very peak of the market, showing that housing prices had gone up enormously and that there was signs of cracks in the housing industry, that the stock prices of the leading home builders in the country had started to taper off. And so technical signals were sent at that time, and we alerted our readers and listeners about that fact. And I think one of the greatest things I've ever experienced in my career as an economist was I got some telephone calls and some emails, I think four or five of them at least, where people thanked me for keeping them out of the housing market, that they would have been financially ruined in 2007 had they bought a house in 2005. And so that was very rewarding and endearing and makes it all worthwhile.
Well, actually, Mark, I ignored your advice completely because I moved to Auburn in 2006 and I said to my wife, I know we're at the top of this bubble, but rental opportunities were practically non-existent for a family of our size. And I just said, well, I'm not planning on going anywhere for a while, so we'll just sit on this thing and do our best. But I know this is going to happen. And of course it did. So I was one of these people who didn't want to hear what you had to say, but I sat there and listened anyway and pouted about it. But why do you think people missed this? If the things you're describing to me are not features of the housing market that one would need a crystal ball to see or would need special access to confidential statistics to see. So, it can't just be wishful thinking on the part of other people.
Well, when you're making money, like people were making money on housing, flipping housing, selling housing, building housing, everybody's making money, everybody's consuming more, they're taking money out of their mortgage and buying, you know, speedboats and RVs and, you know, worldwide trips around the globe and, you know, having so much fun and making so much money and everybody's doing it and it seems so easy and you get so euphoric that all of the reality statistics just go out the window. I recently wrote an article 2 weeks ago about the housing bubble in Norway where I show that housing prices in Norway are completely out of control. And, you know, it's just obvious that what's going on in Norway. And I was criticized in Norwegian financial press that Norway has a good economy, that we have lots of oil revenues, and, you know, we have low unemployment and we have this, that, and the other thing. Well, the reality is their housing sector is way out of control. The housing prices are up significantly, and a lot of the explanations of, you know, looking at the fundamentals, they always say, well, just look at the fundamentals. Well, naturally, the fundamentals are going to stay in line until it's too late. And that's the key, is you have to look beyond the fundamentals like of the unemployment rate and things of that nature. You have to look at what is the Federal Reserve doing? What is it doing to the supply of credit, that fundamental fuel of the economic process? They can artificially expand that credit from what it should normally be. And as a result, they're throwing in jet fuel onto the economy, and you're burning through resources, and prices are inflated as a result of all the heat given off from the Federal Reserve's action. So you have to keep your eye on the Fed. It's the fundamentally destructive factor in the economy, and when they're active, as they are right now, you've got to look out for trouble because that's what they do. They create trouble. They don't. They like to be seen as the solver, the institution that solves all things and keeps everything stable, when in reality, they are the source of economic destruction that is the business cycle. And so you got to keep your eye on the Fed. You got to keep your eye on Bernanke because that's where the action is.
Well, Mark Thornton, I knew the time would fly by, and indeed it has. So I much appreciate your taking the time to talk to us today. I'll look forward to seeing you at the Austrian Economics Research Conference at the Mises Institute next month. And thanks once again for talking to us today.
Thank you, Tom. Enjoyed it.
Mark Thornton, everybody, author of The Economics of Prohibition. Check out his articles at Mises.org.